This is Totally Cool Tech, the show that brings you the hottest in cool technology. No matter if it's old school or new school, high tech or low tech, it's all still cool tech. Hey everybody, you're listening to the Totally Cool Tech Podcast, edition number 548, Spring Has Sprung, for Sunday, April 15th, 2012. I'm Norbert Davis, your host. Hey, that reminds me, April 15th? It's tax day. Well, it's not tax day because it's Sunday, because they don't do taxes on Sunday, and, well, they'll do taxes any day, I guess, but they won't collect it till tomorrow. So, I guess April 16th, 2012, Monday, you've got till midnight to get in your taxes here in America for both federal and your state taxes. I'm done, man. I've been done for a month and a half or so or something like that. I've already got my taxes back and put them to work for me in my bank account. Not like it does a lot of work, but, you know, it's working. It's working. But anyway, that's just kind of like a little side thing. I just kind of noticed that. I forgot that tax day was not going to be April 15th because it fell on a weekend. So I guess the government does that every year. They, you know, every year, if it falls on a weekend, they give you an extra day or so to get it done, or two or whatever. But anyway, all right. Hey, coming up on this week's Totally Cool Tech, we're going to be talking about Google Doodler, engineering germs, not germs, but genes to kill HIV, fake Angry Birds, Barnes & Noble's have a change on an e-reader, robots with muscles, crab computing, space penguins. Is your Best Buy going away? Google BBS style interface. You can do cartwheels on water. This is going to be pretty cool. Got glow-in-the-dark press-on nails for those of you who lived through the 70s and the 80s. You remember the Lee press-on nails. Well, they got a little twist on that one. And we got 3D transistors and server chips and the spy group you've never heard of. That's all coming up on this episode of Totally Cool Tech. But first, Totally Cool Tech is a proud member of the TechPodcasts.com network. If it's tech, it's here. Well, where all our shows are produced, family-friendly, work-safe podcasts, and we really love doing that kind of stuff. And we are also part of Blueberry.com, the podcasters podcasting group. We have a community here where podcasters and listeners can all come together. I think it's a really cool thing to have. You can find any kind of podcast you want over at Blueberry. But if you're looking for tech, go to techpodcasts.com. We've got the best in tech. All right. Now, I want to mention that we are sponsored by GoToMeeting, and you can get a free 30-day trial. How? Well, let me tell you how. Now, with colleagues working from places like here at home or traveling on business like I did last year like crazy, getting everybody together for a meeting can sometimes be an impossible task. But I have the solution. It's GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Your team can meet face-to-face while online, no matter where they are around the world, around the country, in the same city. It doesn't matter. And it takes only seconds. It's so easy. GoToMeeting by Citrix allows you to collaborate on files and plans online. And with HD Faces, you just need a webcam and you can turn your online meetings into an HD group video conference. Now, you can even participate on the go using the built-in camera on your iPad. That is so sweet. Just download the free GoToMeeting app and join in. Now, I love GoToMeeting. I use it frequently at work. It's something we do all the time. We have members in just our little group that can be like me. I was down in Southern California. We have guys that have to actually go out to Toronto. We have guys here in Sacramento. We can all get online and meet, and we can all talk about the same thing. We don't have to have everybody back at this at the main office to talk. It's great. And we can even include, you know, outside of our company, we can consultants and architects and engineers and things like that, and owner and all sorts of things. Because I work in construction. But this is great. You can build your team and meet online. Start hosting your own face-to-face online meetings today with GoToMeeting. My listeners can try it free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. Please be sure to enter that promo code PODCAST. It lets Citrix know that you heard it here from Tech Podcast Network member show. All right. Now, I want to go ahead and just dive right into the show. And we got some really cool stuff right here. And the one thing I really like is the fact that they're going to allow you to become the next Google Doodler. And this is going to be seriously, seriously cool. I have, I'm really not that great as a doodler. I wish I were, but I am not. However, if you are, Google is currently hiring a doodler based in Mountain View, California. A doodler basically designs the homepage doodles within the limits of Google's logo while maintaining collaborative projects on the side and in a very fast-paced work environment. I guess the minimum qualifications for the doodler are a degree in fine arts and 4 years of relevant experience. I've been doodling in meetings for, well over a decade, almost 2 decades now. So I got that part down. I don't have the fine arts degree. But I guess notable doodles in the past were the classic Pac-Man, hopscotch homepage to Martin Luther King, Freddie Mercury's doodle music video, Charlie Chaplin's short film, and guitarist Les Paul's interactive string doodle, among many others. So yeah, if you want to get a job there at Google, go ahead and found this over Geeky Gadgets. Go ahead and click on the link here, and we will link you back to, because it's on here, the Google Jobs. That's pretty cool. I would love to be able to do something like that. All right. What else do we have here? Ah, yes. Engineered genes killed HIV. Well, an HIV virus cell, stuff like that, were killed by engineered stem cells. Well, not in genes, but the stem cells. In a study. Now, this was done in a lab, but while there's still no cure for HIV or AIDS, scientists are working double time to find a solution for it. And, you know, they came up with this great way to work on this. I guess back in 2009, they were able to grow T cells or lymphocytes that normally go out and fight infection from human stem cells that were genetically altered. And I guess this year they were able to further engineer the cells to seek out the cells that were infected by HIV and kill those cells. So it goes out and it does a, you know, not a strategic strike, but I guess a tactical boots on the ground type of strike, instead of like chemotherapy where they, when you're getting chemotherapy for cancer, they kind of treat the whole body roughly. And it kind of does damage to a lot of good cells. Well, this is just like surgical. It goes in and it just seeks out the ones that are bad and kills them. That's really cool. Now, they did find that, you know, when they implanted these cells into these mice in the lab, that after a while there was a noticeable decrease in the number of HIV cells. Or HIV in the body, and the number of T cells has increased, which is great. Now, I guess in humanized mice, I don't really know what that means, but in these lab mice, I guess the HIV mutates in a slower way than it would out in nature. So maybe it did a little bit better because of that, but at least it's encouraging. They can start working to advance even further with the studies that they've been doing. So there's some really cool technology going on out there, some science in that. Because, I mean, back in the early 80s when we first started hearing about HIV and AIDS, and it was really big, that was the scariest thing going on. I mean, it's still scary, don't get me wrong. But to see how far they've come in almost 30 years, it's amazing to see where they're at and what they can do. So maybe in the next 30 years we can, develop a vaccine or something for it, and maybe stop that in its tracks, if not even eliminate it. That'd be really sweet. All right. If you're an Angry Birds player, and I am, you want Angry Birds Space, right? Hey, I got it, and in the first 2 days, I think I completed it. I think there was an update the other day on my Android. However, the folks over at Rovio have gone out of their way to warn new users that their all-powerful game of families, or family of games, Angry Bird Space, to being the latest, watch out. Make sure you get an official version of it. Don't just get it from anywhere. Go to Google Play and get it for Android. Go to iTunes to get it. Don't get it from a third party. It could be bad. It could be... They're calling this one... it's got some sort of... not virus, but... where is it? Here. Hold on. I'll find it. I messed up. Hold on. Lost my place. Yeah, what it's saying is that there's a couple of fake ones that... they're not the official version. They contain either broken version of the game, and it could be more than just the space version of Angry Birds. It could be any of the versions, or worse yet, even hacks. So, you know, to avoid any kind of problems, because, you know, we've seen Max now really getting hacked hard, and, you know, with the advent of antivirus for your iPhones, you know, your droids, and your phones, you know, smartphones, or whatever that you have as far as a mobile device, it's very real. You can get these, you know, malicious content and malicious applications that have content in them that are just going to either, you know, steal data, track you, or, you know, really mess you up. So make sure you get your applications from a very, very trusted site. So I thought I'd throw that warning out there for you, because that's kind of uncool tech when they go ahead and they start throwing viruses and stuff like that at you, malware and so forth. All right. Now, here's something cool. You know, I've told you before that my wife has got the Kindle. We had the original Kindle. And, well, not the original, but the original e-reader style, you know, e-ink style. And then... and then we got the Kindle Fire, and we also have the iPad. She likes her Kindle Fire because she can read at night, because with the original, the other Kindle with the e-ink, you couldn't read at night. You need a night, you know, a little light for it. Well, Barnes & Noble has introduced its new Nook called Simple Touch with Glow Light. It's an e-ink reader device that with patent-pending light technology, which offers adjustable glow for nighttime reading. And it has a paper-like reading experience with, you know, the in the bright sun. So this is pretty cool, to where, you know, at a regular e-reader style, and which is very light, and packs, you know, has the e-ink display. They're very small. They're very light. The batteries last forever on those things. And this new one's going to cost $139, and it can be pre-ordered right now at the Nook, or Nook.com. And you can go ahead to like a Barnes & Noble's, you know, brick and mortar store. Go ahead and get one, or put down on one as well. That is awesome. I think that might be the next generation of e-readers. Because my wife, if she would have had that, she would not have asked for the Kindle Fire. Because we had the iPad. She could, you know, do whatever she wanted to on the iPad. But she could read at night without having, you know, the need for a nightlight. And it lasts. The batteries last forever. With the e-ink, that is just awesome. When with this ability to adjust the glow and basically a backlight for it, that is awesome. It should have been real easy technology to come up with. I don't know why they didn't do it in the beginning. Kind of like, to me, that's a no-brainer. They should have done that. It would just make things that much easier for the users, and it's just a great selling point. So I tend to see this one now going to be the one that everybody's going to go for. You know, Barnes & Noble has one up to Amazon, and this is awesome. This is truly awesome. So that's some really cool technology. Okay, and yeah, what did I say? $139. So $140 or whatever over at Barnes & Noble or Nook.com. Next up, we have scientists build a robot with muscles and joints. Found this over at Slash Gear. And scientists at the University of Sussex, the University of Belgrade, and the Artificial Intelligence Lab at the University of Zurich have been working on a new humanoid-type robot that has muscles and joints, you know, just like a real human, And which means that their movement won't be so rigid, you know, like, you know, doing the robot dance and everybody kind of like breaking and popping and moving real rigidly. It's called the Eckerbot, E-C-C-E-R bot, robot. Oh, Ecker robot? Eckerbot? I don't know. And anyway, you know, right now it is just the torso, so from the, like, from the waist up, that is positioned on a mobile platform, and it has arms that can move flexibly like a human, and they can detect muscular strain, which that's pretty cool. You know, part of the goal is to better understand human movements and figure out how to more accurately represent them the way people would truly move using a robot, or at least, you know, for a robot to do that. In the future, it could lead to robotic creations that are able to have a more complex or do more complex tasks and be able to react with their environment better. They will be able to detect when something is pushing against them rather than just being up against them. So if something had fallen down on their arm, they could detect that better just by the feel, the resistance, you know, or if somebody grabs them or something grabs them, they can understand that better by getting that feedback into the muscles just like humans do. That is so awesome. So this is going to lead to some serious changes in robotics. And I think that sooner or later, you know, you're going to have a true cybernetic type of organism. You know, first it's going to be all mechanical, but sooner or later I bet they will come up with some way to generate some sort of, you know, muscle, some actual muscle that they will be integrating into these things at some point, probably in the next, you know, 40-50 years, but maybe 100 years, but you know, they can come up with something to do that as far as muscle tissue and things like that. And you know, with all the sensors that we've got inside, like our cell phones, I mean, come on, you put that in and into robots and things like that, and strain gauges and so forth, and you'll be able to tell, just like a human, you'll be able to get that biomechanical feedback that'll serve a central processor, and it'll be able to understand what its surroundings are doing to it and how it's affecting its surroundings. That'll be some cool stuff when that happens. Of course, that'll be, you know, the beginning of the end. So, you know, maybe we do need Sarah Connor. I don't know. All right, what else is up? Oh, yeah, I thought this was pretty cool. This is basically crab computing. And, you know, what is that? Well, there was a theory of being able to build a computer based on billiard balls. And when I was reading this this article from Wired, I was like, what are they talking about? Well, I guess with billiard balls, you know, the way they interact with each other, you know, if friction was not a factor, if you can get friction out of it, so you know, you hit a ball and it just keeps going forever. But if two billiard balls hit each other, now there's some certain physics that work with it. You know, they'll go different ways and they'll work off of each other. Anyway, that was done back in the early 1980s. Now, these other guys decided to pick this thing up, you know, this theory up, and run with it. They did a little different. They were using swarms of soldier crabs instead of these billiard balls. Now, the soldier crabs live in flat lagoons and form huge colonies of hundreds of thousands of individuals. But when the tide comes down, they go into an enormous swarm. And they exhibit different behaviors. The crabs on the outside do one thing. The crabs on the inside do a different thing. And the ones on the inside just kind of go with the flow. And the ones on the outside kind of set the pace and determine how things happen and stuff like that. It's pretty interesting. And they fold into each other. You know, the guys on the outside they go into the inside. And the guys from the outside will go to the guys on the inside will go to the outside. So they'll change places and take up those different acts. But when a swarm of crabs is placed into a corridor with walls on each side, the crabs will closely follow the walls like a rolling billiard ball. And this sort of behavior can be easily controlled, for example, by casting a shadow above the swarm to mimic the presence of crab-eating birds, because, you know, they obviously don't want to be eaten, so they go a different way. Well, the whole mass does that, which is pretty interesting. Now, based on these observations of crab behavior, the team built a pattern of channels that act like logic gates, and they found that they could build a decent OR gate using this crab theory. And this was the place where one or two crab swarms are merging into a single one. However, the more complicated AND gate requires that the combined swarm heading down one of three paths. So they found it to be less reliable doing an AND. And however, the team does believe that they could improve the results by creating a more crab-friendly environment. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. But studying the way that crabs work, you know, if one set of crabs is going down one corridor and another one's coming down the other, what happens is, instead of bouncing off each other like billiard balls, they actually kind of merge into one. And if say they're going diagonally, one from lower right to upper left, one from lower left to upper right, and they met at that intersection, instead of continuing on or bouncing off each other, they actually merge, and now they go straight up or straight, which was very, very interesting. So using all this, they're going to try and figure out how to make better logic gates, I guess. And why they're doing it with crabs, I don't know. Maybe they're hungry. Maybe they're going to introduce some cows into this later on. We'll have surf and turf computing. Not really sure, but it was just interesting to see what these guys were coming up with. We went from billiard balls to crabs, and like I say, what's next? You know, throwing in a cow or something like that? I don't know. Weird, but interesting. Interesting. All right. Geeks everywhere are, you know, they're different. They'll come up with weird stuff. That's just so weird. So cool. All right. Now, space penguins. How do you count penguins? I mean, they're down in Antarctica. It's a harsh environment. How do you count these suckers? Well, you do it from space using satellites. Why? Because we have satellites, and you don't have to get down to Antarctica, because you can only get on and off of there so often, and if you get bad weather, you're not moving, and it's a very harsh environment. Well, you get a good day, you can snapshot whatever you want. Perfect, right? Well, that's what they're doing. An international team of scientists use satellite technology to conduct a census of emperor penguin populations from outer space, honing in on their colonies and looking for the brown patches of penguin guano that stand out in the snowy Antarctic. The high-resolution images were taken and used to count the total number of emperor penguins on the continent. The result was a census of 595,000 penguins, which is almost double the previous estimates of 270,000 to 350,000. Now, this includes 7 new colonies, which had not been previously identified, and although this was an uplifting data that they got here, computer modeling still shows that loss of ice flows in the northern reaches could result in problems for the penguins. So, while it kind of looks good right now, it could mean doom later, but maybe if there's a lot of them and we lose some, there'll be enough to maintain the species, and, you know, things will be okay when the next ice age hits. So, good luck there, penguins. All right. I don't know. Would they be angry birds? I guess they would be if they started dying out. So, angry birds counted from space? I don't know. Trying to tie those two together. Really weak. But, yeah, hey, I tried. All right. Now, you've all heard that Best Buy is going to go ahead, and because of Amazon, they're going to be closing a bunch of their big box stores. About 50, so you'd figure out like one per state, right? No, it is not the case. It's going to be anywhere from like, you know, 2 to... Oh, maybe 1 to 4, something like that, per state, but not all the states. Let's see, in Illinois, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in Illinois alone. 1 in Kansas, 1 in 2 in Massachusetts, 2 in Maryland, 1 in, I want to say, Maine, and a couple others everywhere else, you know. Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 here in California. 1 in East Palo Alto. I'm really surprised about that one. Maybe they've got 2 of them or something like that. The one here in Elk Grove, thank God, is still going to be around, because we, you know, we lost Circuit City a couple years ago, and it was kind of nice having Circuit City and Best Buy. I mean, you can, you know, do some serious shopping, you know, and we even have Staples, and even Target now is carrying a lot of computer stuff, and there's also Walmart. But having all those brick and mortar stores, man, you can really do some fine picking on what you want to do for sales. Now with Circuit City gone, you know, we're getting a little thin, and with the threat of Best Buy going away, man, I was seriously like, oh, that's it. We're going to be doing all our shopping online, really, unless, you know, Staples has got some good stuff going now and then. But, I mean, you really got to hunt and pack and really check things out. But if you want it, I got the list here. It's from CNET, so you know it's trusted. And it was put out here not too long ago, so this is the April 14th, so this came out yesterday. Yeah, check it out. It has all of them listed by city, their actual address, the store name, the city name, the address, and the state. So it's got all 50 of them listed. So check that out. See if your local Best Buy is going to be staying around. All right. Now, if you're like me and you started getting online back in the 80s, yeah, that's right, back in the 80s, I used to get onto a BBS called Omni 80 BBS here in the Sacramento Elk Grove area, run by a buddy of mine, Charles Meadows. I think he actually worked for the state and did this part-time, you know, for fun on his own. He ran it out of his house on a Radio Shack Model 1 computer. And folks, let me tell you what, I think maybe that thing had 64K, not gig, not megabytes, not 640, 64K kilobytes. Yeah, 64 kilobytes. And like 2 360K floppy drives. He ran a BBS on that. And the modem, at least the one I connected to him, because, you know, we had to dial up modems. Mine was a 300 baud modem. That was slow. You thought, you know, dial up is slow now? No, that was slow, folks. That painfully, painfully slow. So we had to have everything not graphical. Everything was ASCII. And I guess Google now has Google BBS, a functional BBS style text interface Google that Google implemented in JavaScript. The creator, Austria's Manswerk, gave this online description: Google BBS terminal, what Google would have been, what it would have looked like back in the 80s. And that is so cool. I'm going to get into this a little bit more. I haven't done anything on it. I got to take a look at it. But if you want to know what it was like back in the 80s to get online, check this out. I got a link for it. Found this over at Boing Boing, and it is too cool. It's what it's a menu styled all ASCII text way of finding information. It's the way we used to do it. It was hard, man. It was not easy back then doing anything online. And actually, you know what? It reminds me. I actually had email back then. I believe it was Norbert. Was it Norbert _ Davis at omni80bbs.com? I think that's what it was. God, that was 30. That was right around 30 years ago. Man, I've been online too long. Been online too long. No, not at all. More to do. Okay. Well, yeah, but I've been hanging out online for 30 years now. I remember, you know, downloading ASCII art. It was really cool. You know, everything would be done in letters and numbers and symbols and things like that you would find on a keyboard. Yeah, check it out, because the Google logo is all done using ASCII letters and symbols and all that kind of stuff. And it's really cool. They did a really good job of making some decent graphics out of just letters. It's amazing. Yeah. So check that out. I think you'll like it. I loved it. So I'll have to go get into that a little bit more. And I guess this is by Cory Doctorow. You know him. All right. Over at Gizmodo, I found this, and it's an inflatable mat that lets you walk on water and do other things like cartwheels and so forth. It'll hold up to 1,000 pounds, and they have a photo here on Gizmodo. You're going to have to see this. Five people standing on this mat. It looks like it's about 4 feet wide and about, I don't know, 25 feet long almost. But thing's pretty cool. It's 90 square feet of surface area. Can support up to 1,000 pounds. And it's strong enough to let you run, jump, and even do cartwheels. Everything you've always been encouraged not to do around the water or whatever. But it's an inflatable mat. It has intelligent engineering in it because it's got up to, it can hold up to actually 6 people without sinking or flipping. This is really cool. It has something to do with having some PVC in it. It's a 2-inch thick mat. It's supported by thin PVC piping and an air bladder that can be inflated in about 5 minutes. It can also easily be collapsed and carried in a shoulder bag, but it's going to cost you $1,000. And where are you going to find something like that? Of course, over at Hammacher Schlemmer. You want something, they've got it, and it's usually going to cost you a little bit, but dang, that is cool. I mean, that is definitely the beach party thing to have this year. Be able to sit there and walk on water. I'm not even going to go there. I'm not even going to say anything, but you would be walking on a mat on water, but you know, okay, it's close enough you can get to walking on water. I think it's sweet. Check that out. Okay. Now let's go back into the way back machine again, get Sherman and Mr. Peabody and head on over to the Wayback Machine. And if you remember the 70s and 80s, there was this thing called the Lee press-on nails for women. You know, they want to put their... You talk about fake nails, these are the original fake nails. I mean, these are the press-on ones where I don't know how they did it. I don't think they had double-sided sticky tape, but I'm sure they had some sort of adhesive that would go on. And, you know, they put on all their different types of nails of the French manicure and look and all, whatever. Sparkly ones and whatever. I remember my mom had some of those. Ooh, God. Yeah. That and the blue eyeshadow, I swear. Oh, man, there's some serious therapy going to be going on there, boy. But anyway, these things are kind of coming back and with a whole new look. They should have had these back in the 80s, man. Because that's when we had the neon going on back in the mid-80s, late 80s. We had, glow-in-the-dark style colors going on. Well, now you got these press-on glow stick nails. These things are cool. For $5, you can get a set of 5. And the product is really, really cool. They're mini glow sticks that are built into the shape of a plastic fingernail. You bend the nail gently, just once. It goes ahead and it cracks the little vial or whatever and gets things going. And you attach this double-sided tape to both your fingernail and the plastic one. And you'll watch the reaction. You shake it up and get going. But they're only $5 for 5. So you can only do one hand for $5. So for a full set, you're going to need $10. Okay? And get them over at Amazon. They are cool. Are they Prime available? No, it doesn't look like they're Prime available. But still kind of cool. And yeah, you can get them in blue, pink, and green. And they're pretty large. I mean, they're pretty long. And they're about 2 inches long, it looks. You know, half an inch wide, I guess. 3/4 inch wide. Anyway, those are pretty cool. I mean, kids would love those to go to the raves and things like that. Dances at school or whatever. These might be pretty slick. So, pretty cheap. You know, Halloween maybe. Yeah, definitely cool. So, take a look at it. Like I said, 5 in a set. $5 per set. So you want your old, you know, both hands, going to cost you $10. All right. What else we got? Oh yeah. This is pretty cool. Intel's first server chips with 3D transistors are coming out this quarter. I guess Intel said back on Wednesday, the 11th or 12th, that it will release its first Xeon server chips with 3D transistors this quarter. And a move that analysts said would intensify the cloud hardware battle with their rival Advanced Micro Devices. The company's new Xenon chips will be based on the upcoming Ivy Bridge microarchitecture and initially will be aimed at an emerging category of microservers, Intel said. Microservers are low-powered servers that, with shared components designed mainly for web serving and cloud applications. The new chips will be the new chips will be replacing existing Xeon E3 chips, which were based on the Sandy Bridge microarchitecture. Intel introduced the E3 chips in March last year to jumpstart the microserver category, which it says is still in its infancy, but expected to grow along with web and cloud-based activity in data centers. Now, this is all from PC World, and they go on to say that the new Xeon microserver chips will outperform their predecessors while drawing the same amount of power, the company said, which is Intel's telling us. The driving factors include 3D transistors, which are part of Intel's new 22-nanometer manufacturing process, the 22-nanometer process. Intel has claimed that 3D transistors will consume a little less than about half the power and be about 37% faster than Intel's existing 32-nanometer process chips, which have 2D transistors. The 3D transistor technology, called Tri-Gate transistors, replaces a flat two-dimensional arrangement of transistors with a 3D structure that rises up from the silicon substrate. That's pretty slick. Enthusiast website Anantech has measured a 5% to 15% improvement in CPU performance with the Ivy Bridge compared with the old Sandy Bridge. So there's going to be some serious performance improvements coming along with this. And microservers will be more relevant as data centers try to operate within the physical and economic constraints that they are definitely in right now. Being that I work in construction and we are trying to get into doing more and more of the critical facilities like this, you know, space matters because you got to cool that space. And if you can get one that works less power or works faster for the same power, that is definitely going to be a savings for them one way or another. You know, they can either, you know, spend the money on the cooling, or they can get a savings on upping the speed and the power of the processor. So yeah, if they can't, you know, make it work a little cooler, make it work a little faster for the same amount, you know. That is pretty cool. I can't wait to see what's going on, especially with this 3D technology of creating transistors that are going to be going three dimensions instead of two. So that's going to be interesting to see how the processors go. Maybe we'll start to see processors again that are like the old Pentium 3s, where they were thick. They were huge. Maybe we're going to start getting thicker processors. I don't know. We'll see here in the near future. All right. Last up. And I thought this was pretty cool. This is, I call it the spy group you've never heard of. And from Business Insider for Military and Defense, this article called The Special Collective Service is the U.S. spy agency that nobody's ever heard of. And they are. I never even knew about them until today, until I started reading this. Soon Congress will be drafting legislation reauthorizing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which serves as the legal framework for domestic espionage against external threats. You know, after weathering criticism and high-profile legal challenge in 2005 for its warrantless wiretapping program, and we have a decent idea of the sophisticated and controversial methods that the NSA employs to penetrate global telecommunication network. You know, they've been under the gun, and they're going to be coming back up in spotlight again here. Still in the shadows, however, is a secretive joint program that they have with the Central Intelligence Agency that's codenamed F6, but rather better known as the Special Collections Service. The Special Collections Service is America's master of covert eavesdropping, placing super high-tech bugs in unbelievably hard-to-reach places and using cutting-edge technology to crack supposedly impenetrable encryption. And I guess One of the people over at the Federation of American Scientists put it best, when you think of NSA, you think of satellites. When you think of CIA, you think of James Bond and microfilm. But you don't really think of an agency whose sole purpose is to get up real close and use the best technology there is to listen and transmit. That's the SCS. Now, officially, the Special Collection Service doesn't exist. They're like Area 51. And it isn't headquartered in a guarded complex on a densely forested 300-acre lot outside of Beltsville, Maryland. But according to journalist James Bamford, the organization was founded in 1978 to bridge the NSA's ability to infiltrate foreign networks and the CIA's ability to penetrate foreign countries. Its leadership alternates between the director of either of those two organizations. And at the Beltsville facility, special tactics for tradecraft are devised and are kind of in a kind of a mad scientist laboratory develops a new technology all the time for use out in the field. So this, they've got some really, really covert stuff going on here. And I guess the special collections elements are made up of 2 to 5 people, which rotate into U.S. embassies around the world, working undercover as foreign service officers or members of the Diplomatic Telecommunications Service. And when the State Department cover is impossible, the agents enter countries under the guise of business people. So, you know, all those spy movies you see where people are supposedly got fake businesses and things like that, yeah, that is true, and that's how these guys get in there and do their work. Now, the utility of the Special Collections Service is a self-evident thing. While the raw computing power found at National Security Agency headquarters seems limitless, signals intelligence has always been a cat-and-mouse type of game. Every time the United States finds a way into a foreign network or decipher some elaborate encryption, foreign powers find a way to shut us out again. It's been that way since the NSA's precursor, the Armed Forces Security Agency, operated out of Arlington Hall Junior College for Women. Now, having someone on the ground and eyes and ears on a target effectively bypasses most technological shielding, and that's always the best way. You have to have boots on the ground, someone in there. You can't beat a human for doing this kind of thing. Because they do all the processing power in their head and they understand what's going on. They can react better. But still, the secret collection or the special collective service, that is awesome. I mean, these guys are the black ops of black ops. This is where the NSA and the CIA go to get their toys and have things done. These are their subcontractors in a way. That is totally cool. Did not know about these guys. I wonder, I'd love to see some of the technology that they come out with. I mean, if they ever had something that they're like, you know what? Yeah, okay, this has been done. It's done, seen that, have the t-shirt, you know, this old hat right now. It's old school. I'd love to see some of that stuff, that technology, you know. It's like your USB drive could be, you know, anything. Could be, you know, a transmitter, a little mini computer in there that's decrypting everything you say. And you think you're just, you know, using it to store data for yourself. It could be anything. It could be a watch. It could be a credit card, for crying out loud. Yeah, you know, these guys have probably got, you know, buttons sewn onto people's jackets that are microtransmitters and recorders and things like that. That's incredible. So, wow. Amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing. All right. Well, hey, you know what? That's going to be it for today. I appreciate you guys listening. If you have any questions, comments, please email me at norbert@totallycooltech.com, or you can use the old standard there, tctpodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, please recommend us to a friend. I really appreciate it. All of the show notes and links, plus all my contact info, we're going to be over at the website at www.totallycooltech.com. All right. Hey, if you know about some cool tech and you think we ought to be talking about it on the show, please go ahead and send it in to me. Maybe even make a little, you know, audio, you know, file for whatever it is you want to talk about. Keep it clean. We'll put it on the air here. That would be so cool. I'd love to hear from you. Or just let me know what you're using or anything like that you want me to talk about. Send it in. I'll talk about it. just go ahead and send it in to Norbert at totallycooltech.com, or you can even call the Totally Cool Tech podcast listener line, area code 540-999-TECH. Look for me on Twitter. Just look for TCT Podcast, and that'll be it. All right, everybody. That's it. I will see you next time.